Well, good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium. My name is Nigella Hillgarth and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium. And on behalf of all of us, it's a great pleasure to welcome you here tonight to the most recent Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science Lectures. And it gives me great pleasure this evening to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Shad O'Neill. And he is a postdoc here at Scripps. In fact, he is what is known as a Green Scholar. And I was quite interested to know what that meant. It doesn't mean he's green. It means he's funded through the Cecil and Ida M. Green Foundation for Earth Science. So not surprisingly, he has a very good background in geology. He did his BA in environmental geology at the University of Montana. And then he started specializing in glaciology. He did his master's in geophysics at the University of Alaska, and then his PhD at the University of Colorado Boulder. He is a glacier specialist. I have to confess here, being English, I want to say glacier. So I've been worried about this all day, but I'm trying hard. And he's worked on projects in all the places that you would expect someone in this with this expertise to work, in Antarctica and Alaska and Iceland, just to mention a few places. And his research focuses particularly on observation-driven glacier ice sheet dynamics, how fast they flow, and how icebergs calve. And he uses a lot of technology that was originally developed by people studying the movement of solid earth, seismology. And so I'm very excited to introduce him tonight because he's somebody who really has first-hand experience in the field. It's what's happening to the disappearing of these amazing glaciers. And so tonight, please help me welcome Shad as he talks about disappearing glaciers and the rising sea.
Okay, well, thanks, Nigella, for the introduction. And we'll get going here. So my talk was introduced already. I'm going to talk about glaciers, try and give you some background to how glaciers work and why they're important in Earth system science, and talk about what's happening to sea level and how glaciers play a role in changes in sea level. A lot of people deserve thanks for having me here tonight. The Scripps Birch Aquarium and Cheryl Peach for inviting me here. My postdoc supervisor, Helen. Mark Meyer led a lot of the work that I'm going to talk to you about. And then Steve, Scott, Anthony, and Jason all provided slides that I'll show during the talk. So there's several things that you should listen for during my talk tonight that are interesting and important. The first is that rising sea levels are expensive. Often that socioeconomic impacts of climate change are overlooked, and I want to try and point that out tonight. The skin of ice that covers a big part of the Earth's surface is losing mass, and this mass is all going into the ocean and causing the ocean to grow. And that's going to be the focus of my talk. I'm going to talk about how the loss or the transfer of ice from land to the sea where it melts is accelerating in time quite quickly. And I'll make my main point tonight will be that what's happening today isn't that the sea level is rising from the disintegration of the ice sheets, but more importantly, it's the small glaciers that are disappearing the fastest. They're showing the biggest sensitivity to climate warming, and these are the ones that are going to impact us in the coming century. Okay, so I'll start with this cliche slide from Glacier National Park. This is in the news a lot today. This is Grinnell Glacier. In 1940, you can see it up here, covers almost the whole picture. And then by 2006, there's not much left. And so not only has the glacier length changed, but the thickness of the glacier has changed quite a bit too. And when glaciers melt, the water that's generated is transferred into the ocean, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. And we call this the eustatic component of sea level change. That is, the new water that's added to the ocean. And about 60% of the eustatic sea level change is coming from the glaciers, the small glaciers around the world, not the great ice sheets. And this is something that might be surprising to a lot of people, and that might be harder to swallow, but I'll try and convince you that that's true during the next 45 minutes. So how does the budget of the ocean work, the volume of the ocean, how does that change? There's a couple different things that I'm going to focus on tonight. The first is called thermal expansion, or the steric change in sea level rise. So if we have water in the ocean and we warm the ocean, those little molecules are moving around faster and taking up more volume. And that causes the volume of the ocean to increase. There's some other things that also play a minor role. Over short timescales, the circulation of the ocean can cause it to change its volume. We can have tectonic effects like subsidence at river deltas or isostatic rebound. If we remove ice from the planet, that might cause local sea level rise or fall. And then terrestrial water storage also plays a minor role. That is the storage of water in lakes and rivers and groundwater. But the big player that I'm going to focus on for the rest of the time is the exchange of water that's stored on land as ice with the ocean. And right now what's happening is we're having the addition of water into the ocean. So how do we know that this is happening? This is a figure from Steve Narum at University of Colorado, who's one of the experts in measuring global average sea level from space. And he uses satellite altimetry to measure what's happening to the ocean's volume. And this curve starts at 1993 and goes to the present time. And you can see this linear trend that shows us that sea level is going up by about 3.5 millimeters per year. That's not very much. It's only about that much. But over the next 100 years, that's 35 centimeters, which translates to over a foot of sea level rise, which is a big change in sea level. He breaks this down into this thermal expansion part, which is about half the total observed rise, and about half of the rest of it is coming from transfer of ice from land to the sea. Then there's this question mark at land water storage, but because these other components add up to the observed rise, we can say that this is probably not a very important part. So if we look at the observations of sea level rise and compare them to the predictions, we can extend the observations back further in time to about 1970. We can even go back further than that if we wanted to, but this will show the point. These observations are from tide gauges, and they tie in really nice to satellite observations of sea level change. There was recently a talk of the discrepancy between these two observation methods, but you can see they tie together quite nicely. And then there was a few predictions made in 1990. Each one of these curves is a prediction of what might happen to sea level made in 1990. And you can see that the observations are tracking the worst case scenario, that is the maximum rate that we thought that sea level would go up. So all of this rising ocean levels have economic implications. Here's an example from Thailand, where the city of Bangkok is home to about 20 million people, and the red shows the area that would be inundated by the ocean with a 2-meter change in sea level. So you get an understanding that way of how expensive moving these people or preventing the sea from invading the city would be from this kind of change. Now, a 2-meter change in sea level seems pretty big, and it's not something that we probably are going to have to deal with in the next century. But as the sea rises, it makes more and more people vulnerable to things like storm surges and coastal erosion and coastal drowning. To bring this closer to home, I show the Louisiana coast and the Florida coast with 1-meter changes in sea level. So the Everglades National Park is one area of the United States that's very susceptible to sea level change. And here in Louisiana, the problem is exacerbated by this by the Mississippi River Delta, where a lot of sediment is going out into the ocean and depressing the land surface even more, just the weight of the sediments. So that's my motivation for studying glaciers and how they work at changing sea level. And I've hopefully given you some reason to believe that it's a worthy topic to think about. But being that we're in Southern California, a lot of you probably don't have any experience with glaciers. So I want to give you some background in what a glacier is, how they work, And then we'll tie this back to the problem of ice going into the sea. So this doesn't show up that great, but this is a scanning electron microscope picture of the primary ingredient of a glacier. That is a snowflake. And without snow, we can't have glaciers. Glaciers exist where it snows more several years in a row, several decades in a row, than it melts each year. So this process of changing snow to ice can happen quickly or it can happen slowly, depending on the local climate. It takes between 5 and a couple hundred years to change snow into ice. So up here is a brand new snowflake that's fallen. And as they land on the ground, most of the volume is filled with air. In fact, new snow is about 90% air. But then as vapor transport processes and compaction of more snow that falls on top work on the snow, they serve to round the grains and push them closer together. And once the density of the snowpack reaches the point where air can't travel through the little pore spaces, then we have this substance which we call ice. And it's just these little rounded grains, and there's less than 20% air in the material. And then we have what's called ice. So it has to snow more than it melts to get a glacier, but there's all different kinds of glaciers. So it can snow more than it melts, but not sustain a glacier, and that's what we call a snow field or a snow patch. And these are kind of fun places to go skiing in the late summer when you're trying to ski each month of the year. But you can tell it's not a glacier. There's rocks poking through. So that's sort of the smallest case. Then this is more what you might envision from a glacier. These are valley glaciers in the Alaska Range. You can see the glaciers coursing through the valleys, going from high elevations to low elevations through the mountains. And I think this is what we typically think of if someone says the word glacier. But on an even larger scale, a much larger scale, are the ice sheets. The two big ice sheets are in Greenland and Antarctica, and this is what they look like. They look very similar to the ocean, except they're white instead of blue. They're flat, huge expanses of ice that are often a couple kilometers thick, and they seem to go on endlessly. But when you take a closer look at them, they're actually really interesting and unique places. This is a picture of Antarctica, and we commonly divide Antarctica by this mountain range here that cuts across. We call this West Antarctica and this East Antarctica, and I'll refer to those over and over tonight. And what's shown in color is how fast the glaciers are moving, or the ice sheet is moving. So in dark blue is the slowest ice. This shows the highest parts of the ice sheet. And in red is the fastest ice. And you'll notice that the fastest moving ice is concentrated all around the edges of the ice sheet. And it looks like little rivers sticking back into the ice sheet. And these are the outlet glaciers. And these outlet glaciers turn out to be really, really, really important. And we just learned about them within the last 20 years. So these fast-flowing streams of ice really serve to move the ice from the interior of the ice sheet to the margins and then into the ocean. So to better understand how this is working, we need to have a little bit of a background on glacier dynamics, a big scary word. So ice dynamics is how the glaciers flow, how the ice is moving, and how it's responding to perturbations in temperature or snowfall. So there's a couple pictures here. This upper one doesn't show up very well, so we'll pretty much ignore that one. But this lower one is important. This is a cartoon glacier looking at it from the side. And there's some words here that describe the physics of how a glacier works. The uppermost part of the glacier is called the accumulation area. That one's intuitive. It's where there's more snow each year than melt, and the glacier's gaining mass. Down at the bottom, we have the ablation area, which is just a fancy word for melting. So down low on the glacier, we're having more melt than snowfall each year. And in between those two is this thing I labeled as the ELA, the equilibrium line altitude. So this is the height on the glacier, the elevation where there's the same amount of snow as it melts. And so I've drawn this orange wedge on top of the surface of the glacier to represent the mass gain and loss on this little cartoon glacier. And you can see that generally accumulation increases up towards the top and melt increases down towards the bottom. Pretty intuitive. And what happens is that each year this mass that's added flows down to replace the mass that's removed. And if the glacier's in balance with its climate, then there's no net change in the glacier shape. If, however, it's got a negative mass balance or mass budget, you can think of it like a checkbook, the glacier will thin and retreat because there's not enough mass being supplied to compensate the losses. Conversely, if we're adding more mass, we'll thicken and advance the glacier. And that's why these flow vectors look the way that they do, how it's down up high and then it turns and comes up at the terminus to resupply the melting. And you'll see that the flow is slowest near the bed and fastest near the surface. And I'll show you that again in the next slide. So we'll zoom in a little bit on a little section of the glacier, again, looking at it from the side. And we want to think about how the ice is actually flowing downhill. And there's three components to the total motion. And the easiest way to visualize this is to think about drilling a hole in the glacier and then coming back the next year and measuring the shape of the hole. So in this cartoon, I've made this pretend hole that goes all the way through. And we do drill holes in glacier just by pouring hot water through a hose. You can just melt your way through. It's pretty simple. So if you come back in a year, though, and you slide an inclinometer down the hole wouldn't be straight anymore, nor would it be in the same place. And that's because ice deforms viscously. You can think of it like silly putty. If you took a blob of silly putty and put it on your table and then had your son or daughter lift it up over their head all day long, if you came back, that silly putty would have flowed down the table just under its own weight. Well, glacier ice acts the same way. It's just moving downhill under its own weight, deforming under the force of gravity. And so that's what makes this imaginary borehole look like this. And it's the stresses are big at the bottom and they're zero at the surface, but all of the ice up here is sort of moving along, deforming along, and so you get the maximum displacement on the surface and the minimum on the bed. And so this deformation component that looks just like the deformation of a metal near its melting point is shown here by this part of the motion. But there's two other important parts that don't always have to exist. This deformation part is always going to be there. But then we have this sliding part and this till part. So till is just what we like to call mud. And there's oftentimes mud at the bottom of the glacier because the glacier is going to erode the bedrock, which sits even underneath the mud. And the mud doesn't always act as a very strong base. And so especially if it gets wet, it'll deform and the ice will slide along on top of the deforming mud. And so that's illustrated down here. It can either deform just like the deformation in the ice, or it can slip on itself, and that's more like the sliding part. And so then the last part is the sliding, which is a simple thing to visualize. It's just the glacier slipping along as a plug or a block on top of its bed. And so I've sketched in the component of sliding with this dashed line, and you can see that all the ice moved the same amount. And if we add all three of those together, we'd get the total surface displacement of the ice. Okay, so that's some science now, some pictures. You guys can digest that, think about it a little bit, and then we'll move on to some more science. What do these things look like? For people who haven't been on a glacier before, it's probably pretty hard to conceptualize those pretty basic things that I was talking about. So we'll just have a little photo tour. Here we are up in the accumulation. It's two people and a dog, and we're skiing along. This is like August, early August, and you can see there's fresh snow. We're up pretty high in the mountains. There's more snow than it melts. That's the accumulation zone. And if it was darker, you could see up in here some stratigraphy in the snowpack that shows you how much it's snowing each year. In contrast to that is the ablation area, where it's melting more than it snows. This is in the dry valleys in Antarctica. You can see this icy surface of the glacier. And here it's not actually melting. The ice is just, the snow just sublimates away. We're in a really dry desert and it never gets above freezing. And that's part of the reason the seal carcass is preserved on the glacier surface. It's so cold and dry there that the seal, which is dated at between 2,000 and 3,000 years old, has just been mummified on the glacier surface. But the thing to take home is that this is an icy surface. There's not a lot of snow around. And again, it's in midsummer. Okay, so let's get a little bit more sophisticated and start talking about the health of the cryosphere, or the world's glaciers. And so what we need to do to describe the health of the glacier system is talk about the mass budget. So how much is the whole cryosphere gaining or losing in terms of mass? And until very recently, only like a decade ago, this is upper picture is the way all glaciologists thought of glaciers responding to climate forcing. We thought that this was a very slow process on the order of decades to centuries for the glaciers and centuries to millennia for the ice sheets. And so the slow response is governed by the surface balance, that is how much it's snowing and melting. If you add snow more than it melts, the glacier or ice sheet will grow, get thicker in advance. But what we've recently discovered is that this process has now been put on the back burner. We understand it fairly well. The response of the glaciers to changes in snowfall are comprehensible. But since we've discovered these outlet streams that I showed you in Antarctica, we've realized, wow, the ice sheets, they can respond really quickly. Less than decadal timescale variations in ice sheet geometry. This is new stuff to us. We thought, wow, the ice sheets are easy. They don't respond very fast. Nobody has to worry for a really long time. But these fast rivers of ice have a rapid response, one that we don't really understand. It's highly nonlinear, and the glacier geometry can change on very short timescales. And the process by which this happens is iceberg calving. And this is a picture of iceberg calving, where you have instantaneous transfer of large quantities of ice from terrestrial storage into the ocean. The ocean is warm, the icebergs melt, and you've suddenly added large quantities of water into the ocean. Okay, so now we're into the guts of it, the state of the cryosphere. What's happening to the world's glaciers and ice sheets? So first, this is stepping back a little bit. Where is the ice on planet Earth? And so I've shown a picture here from the bottom of our planet and from the top. And you can see these ice sheets. The ice sheets stand out when you look at the Earth this way. Here's Antarctica, and you can't really see it, but there's a different color blue that shows where the sea ice is. And there's a good bit of sea ice around Antarctica. And then from the north, here's Greenland. And then this is all sea ice right here. And so I don't want to say a whole lot about sea ice, but I do want to mention that sea ice isn't important for sea level rise. You can think of it like if you put ice cubes in a glass and then leave it out in the hot sun for a while, the ice will melt, but the glass isn't going to spill all over the table, because that ice is already floating. It's in equilibrium with the water. But the sea ice is very important because notice the contrast from a light white color on the ice to a dark blue, sometimes even black-like color over the ocean. And this color change, this albedo change, really affects how energy is absorbed or reflected over the sea ice. And right now, although we're still not to the end of summer, the sea ice extent is smaller than it ever has been in the Arctic. So the sea ice is changing really rapidly, and I'm not going to talk about that much, but it's really important. You can also see the Alaskan glaciers up here, and you can see the glaciers in the bottom tip of South America over here. So that's kind of neat, even from space. So where is all the ice? Antarctica comprises the vast majority of all the freshwater ice on Earth. Close to 90% of the ice volume is locked up in the Great Ice Sheet of Antarctica, the West Antarctic and the East Antarctic Ice Sheet. And if we melted the Antarctic Ice Sheet completely, we'd get it between 55 and 60 meters of sea level rise. That's a huge number. I mean, we're burying tons and tons of people under the water. If we go to Greenland, it's about 8 times smaller, 9 times smaller. About 10.5% of the ice is locked up in Greenland. It's a much smaller ice sheet. And if we melted it completely, we'd get 6 to 8 meters of sea level rise. Okay, so then the thing that I'm babbling to you about is the small glaciers. Why are they important? You can see here they're less than 1% of the total freshwater ice volume on the Earth. And if we melted them all the way, we'd only get 0.5 to 0.75 meters. So less than 3 feet of sea level rise. Why am I saying that they're important? It's because they're changing really fast right now, and even a small change in sea level is important. The ice locked up in the big ice sheets is in really cold environments, and it's not as sensitive to climate warming. And so we're not seeing as fast of a response of those systems as we are from the small glaciers. So we'll take a little tour of these three regions, the Antarctic ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet, and the small glaciers of the world, taken as a collective. So we glue them all together in this imaginary space. And the method that I'm going to show you is called GRACE. So this is a new satellite that's flying around the Earth, and it uses gravity variations to look for mass transfer. And this guy, Scott Luthke at NASA, is really the one pioneering this technique. This is a brand new technique, and it's greatly improving our ability to understand the state of health of the cryosphere. So here's Scott's results over Antarctica, where blue indicates the maximum mass loss and red colors indicate the mass gains. So what you see right away is that the West Antarctic ice sheet is losing mass, and we use a funny unit here called gigatons. So I'll show you what it is in cubic miles in the next slide, but basically it's a lot of ice. A gigaton is 10 to the 6 tons of ice. And you can see that the West Antarctic ice sheet is losing about 120 gigatons of ice per year. That means that's in exceeding what it's receiving as snowfall. So it's not like it's just melting that much. That's after we subtract the snowfall. We get about minus 120. On the other hand, the East Antarctic ice sheet is gaining mass. This takes a little bit to wrap your head around, but because it's so cold in Antarctica, as we warm it up a little bit, it's easier for it to snow, and there will be snow on more days of the year. And so that translates to we're gaining mass over the East Antarctic ice sheet. But taken together between these two ice sheets, we're losing about 105 gigatons per year. We can translate that into global sea level rise, and we get a third of a millimeter. So that's a really small amount of sea level rise from Antarctica. So now we'll move to Greenland. And remember that Greenland is 8 or 9 times smaller than Antarctica in terms of the volume of ice that's stored in the ice sheet. Again, this is from Scott, and this figure's a little bit different. And unfortunately, we've only had this satellite since 2003. But what he shows here is the variation in mass over Greenland, and you can see it goes up and down, gaining mass in the winter, losing mass in the summer, but overall it's been losing mass through the past few years. And there is a question of whether this is a long-term trend or just a short-term variation, and that's a very valid concern, and we don't have the answer to that. But what's really important is right now in our life, the Greenland ice sheet is losing a lot of ice. That's something that we want to address no matter how long-term it is, because it's going to add a substantial amount of water, more than can be recovered from the ocean in the near future. So in Greenland, we're losing about 150 gigatons of ice per year, so a bit more than from Antarctica, even though this ice sheet is much, much smaller. So let's try and conceptualize how much ice that is. 154 gigatons is 40 cubic miles of water. That's a lot of water. It's about 2.5 times the water in the Chesapeake Bay, or 10 times the annual average discharge of the Colorado River. And so the Greenland ice sheet is adding about 0.4 millimeters a year of ice to the ocean. Okay, so the next place to look is Alaska. What's happening in Alaska? And Alaska turns out to be the fastest region of change for the glaciers on the planet. And Scott can work on these glaciers with GRACE because they're clustered in a pretty tight region here of south central and southeast Alaska. So he's looking from southeast Alaska up towards Anchorage and a little bit in the Alaska range. We have the same time series from 2003 to the present of these mass gain in the winter, mass loss in the summer, with a negative slope indicating an overall loss of ice to the sea. Now the trend in Alaska is about 100 gigatons per year, so it's about the same as Antarctica. But remember that 90% of the ice is in Antarctica and less than 1% is in Alaska. If we use some other methods to sum the mass loss for all the glaciers, we get about 400 gigatons per year, and that's more than both of the ice sheets combined. So that's a big change that's happening to the small glaciers, and it's happening really fast. So I want to return to this question of what's important in governing the health of the cryosphere. Are we talking about changes in mass balance? Is snow and melt the most important thing to pay attention to? Or is this nebulous ice dynamics term more important in governing the shape and health of the cryosphere? So this is a picture. This is Wortman Glacier in Alaska. And we understand what's happening at Wortman Glacier to a pretty high level. It's warming up, it's not snowing as much in the winter, and it's melting more in the summer. The glacier's losing mass. And it's all the water comes out in this little stream, and we can measure it, and we can figure out from little glaciers like this how much is being lost. It seems pretty simple. But not all the glaciers end on the land. So I want to introduce you in more detail to ice dynamics. Oh no, okay, it is working. So this is Columbia Glacier in Alaska, where the ice dynamics are really, really important. This is a time-lapse sequence from spring to fall of 2005. We're looking at 6 images each day. And this ice at the terminus is moving about 15 to 30 meters a day. It varies quite a bit. And you can really start to see on a daily time scale this delivery of ice from land to the sea. You can see the ice moving forward, and if you pay attention to this terminus position, you'll see that it's advancing and retreating on really short time scales. And you can see all the icebergs going into the water and being flushed out into the ocean. And in 2005, the glacier changed the most in the fall. So as we're starting to get towards fall, you start to see night coming in here, and if you're crafty, you'll see the aurora. But pay attention to this terminus and watch for a big jump in the terminus position towards the end of the fall through major, huge calving events. So here's the terminus here, and watch for it. It'll jump way back to there. We lost about a cubic kilometer of ice in one night at Columbia Glacier. So boom, there it is. You can see it's way back here. And that change just happened over one evening. So you can start to see that these dynamic changes are really important, and they're happening much, much faster than to the glaciers that end in the sea than to the glaciers that end on the land. And one of the ways that this is happening is through iceberg calving. So iceberg calving is this process where ice is breaking off of the terminus of glaciers that end in the water, that is the tidewater glaciers in Alaska and the outlet glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica. And I'll show you some examples of what iceberg calving looks like. This is a little calving event. You see this ice cliff is about 60 to 70 meters tall, so it's a couple hundred feet tall. And just this little flake is spalling off, a couple hundred foot piece of ice falling off into the ocean and making waves that Garrett over here likes to surf. So it's pretty neat, and I'll show you a picture of these guys surfing in Alaska. But this is the very smallest iceberg that can fall off of a glacier. These get much bigger. So here's a medium-sized iceberg calving event, also from Columbia Glacier. And notice how it's being propelled up out of the water. This ice is grounded on the bottom of the ocean, so only about about 20% or so is sticking up above the water. There's about 500 meters of ice below the water. And as you watch that movie, see if I can get it to go one more time, you see the ice being propelled upwards by buoyancy forces. Maybe it won't play again. Oh well, you'll watch another one. And it rotates around, and we're talking about a major, big, instantaneous change in the glacier geometry. Columbia Glacier can make even bigger calving events. This boat that you can barely see right here holds 100 people. And this is a couple minutes into a calving event. The ocean was clear of ice debris before the event started. Here we're 3 or 4 minutes in. Now we're 5 minutes in. And by 15 minutes, we've covered about 25 square kilometers of the ocean surface with iceberg debris from the glacier. Glacier probably retreated 100 meters during this event, so that's about 300 feet or a whole football field of the glacier from the top down to the ocean bottom, broke off and went into the ocean in 20 minutes. Columbia Glacier is a little glacier. It's only a mile and a half wide over here, and it's only 500 meters thick. If we go to Greenland, things get even bigger. So this is Jakobshavn in Greenland. If you pay attention to the news, you may have heard about Jakobshavn. It's been pretty popular in the press recently. This is about 10 kilometers across, so about 6 miles. And this ice cliff is about 100 meters tall. This is a time-lapse sequence that Jason Amundsen from University of Alaska made. He had a camera on a tripod and was taking pictures every 10 seconds for 20 minutes. This is the biggest ocean mixer that probably exists in the world. That's an 800 meter tall paddle mixing the ocean from the bottom to the top. This is one of the most dynamic systems on the face of our planet right now. And I don't know that anyone's figured out even a back of the envelope estimate of how much ice was lost during that calving event. We can look at even bigger icebergs that are calved off from Antarctica. The difference is that they're calved off of the floating ice shelves, so they're kind of like the sea ice. They're already floating. If they melt, they're not going to make sea level go up, but they do buttress the glaciers and ice sheets behind them and make them flow more slowly than they do once the icebergs break off. You can barely see this iceberg. This is iceberg C16. It broke off in 2000 from the Ross Ice Shelf with iceberg B15, and those two combined were about the size of the state of Rhode Island. So here's an animation from satellite imagery of Pine Island Glacier. And we have this tabular iceberg breaking off. We're taking another leap up in scale. This is about 100 kilometers or 60 miles across. And this broke off in less than 1 year. Again, it's floating ice. It doesn't have a direct impact on sea level rise. But Pine Island Glacier behind it accelerates dramatically because it lost this ice shelf buttressing as the ice broke off. How do these changes manifest on the glaciers? I work in Alaska. I work on Columbia Glacier. So most of my examples are from Columbia Glacier. But here is what's happened to Columbia Glacier over the past 25 years. There's two red arrows. There's one on this peak right here called the Great Nunatak in both of the images. And then there's one pointing to the terminus. You see it's back by the Great Nunatak in 2003, but it was way out here in 1980. So between 1980 and today, we've lost about 15 kilometers of length of this glacier. It's thinned by over 400 meters at the present terminus, so that's over 1,000 feet. And you can see that thinning as this bathtub ring that goes all the way around the glacier. And I'll show you how the details of the dynamics, but as the glaciers retreated, the forward flow of the ice is actually accelerated. So we're not just removing this portion of the glacier, we're pulling down a huge reservoir of ice from upstream. Okay, so in the short term, since I've studied Columbia Glacier, what's happened? We're going to look at the change from May 2004 till September 2006. And you can see a dramatic change in both the length and the thickness at the calving margin. So I'll play that one more time. Maybe. Should go here. Okay. So it's a pretty rapid and substantial change in a very short period of time. And you can see this bathtub ring in these images a lot better. This mountain's about 4,000 feet tall, so that's where the thickness of the glacier was in 1980, right there. So it's pretty drastic change. Okay, so let's summarize that dynamic component of the glacier system health. There's nonlinear dynamics operating at the glaciers that end in the ocean. This is because they extend down to the bottom of the ocean, and the water that the glaciers produce from melting has a hard time getting out, and so it lubricates the bed of the ocean. And the glaciers want to float on this high-pressure water that gets stuck underneath the glacier. That reduces the friction between the ice and the rock and allows the glaciers to flow really fast. And as they flow fast, they crack themselves up and they break off even faster than they're flowing via iceberg calving. So here's this example of what happens to the velocity field of a marine terminating glacier as it enters retreat. This is going from upstream to downstream before the retreat started and once the retreat was underway. So this is slow, about a kilometer a year the ice was moving, and once the retreat started, we're up near 12 kilometers a year. And you can see that the pulling at the front is extending very far upstream. And that is drawing the ice into the sea. What we don't understand is, why do these retreats start? Are they reversible? And what controls the rapidity of the retreat? And those are the questions that glaciologists are really focusing on right now to try and improve our understanding of sea level rise. So here's these guys out surfing at Childs Glacier this summer, just for a little lighthearted break. And what we're seeing in the glacier dynamics is that these rapid retreats are increasingly widespread, and the speed increases, the calving increases even more, and this is all happening on really short timescales. So we're going to... Okay, so there they are out getting ready to go. These guys are absolutely nuts. So we're going to bring this back to what's happening to sea level rise. I think I've built your intuition a little bit on how glaciers work, what their state of health is, and how they're tied into the ocean system. So we just had a paper published in Science last week, if you want to take a better look at this stuff. What we did was try and make some sort of prediction on what's going to happen over the next 100 years. And I just want to beat this point home. Why bother with the small glaciers? Well, sea level's rising fast, and it's getting faster every year, and a lot of people live close to the ocean, ourselves included. This transfer of mass from land to the sea affects the whole Earth. There's the obvious one of coastal drowning and storm damage, but there's some more subtle ones, like adding a bunch of ice into the ocean can change ocean circulation, which can feed back on the climate. That's a huge unknown right now. We know it's happened in the past. We have no idea what it takes to make that happen. And one thing that I'm not going to touch on but should be mentioned, it's really important, is water resources. There's not very many people that get their water, drinking water, from the Greenland or Antarctic ice sheet. But a lot of people around the planet get their drinking water from glaciers. And that's going to be another one of these big socioeconomic problems. This mass transfer is accelerating with little end in sight. And glaciers are a big player in this process. We really need to understand these ice dynamics much better than we do to make our predictions better. What we did in this recent study is we tied together all of the available data on glacier health, the mass budget of the cryosphere, from surface observations, airborne laser altimetry, satellite altimetry, and this GRACE satellite. And we combined them all, being very careful because each method has its different footprint. It can see different regions of change better than the others. And being very careful because the field that we're studying is accelerating. The changes are the rate of change of the mass transfer is changing very quickly. So we need to be careful that we compare all the measurements over similar timescales to make any sort of prediction. So here's the available data from the three cryosphere systems that I've been talking about, the small glaciers, Greenland, and Antarctica. And the first thing that you can see from this plot is that we haven't been able to estimate the mass budget of Greenland and Antarctica for very long. Only since the mid-90s have we even been able to make a guess whether they're gaining mass or losing mass. And that's only since the advent of these satellite systems that we can do that. The second thing is that most of the ice masses are shrinking. That's shown by a positive trending. So this shows the rate of mass loss. So an upward trend means that the system is losing mass to the ocean. And so you can see that all the small glaciers are losing mass, Greenland is losing mass, and West Antarctica is losing mass. Only East Antarctica, is gaining mass. And that mass gain is very small. The small glaciers are dominating, especially up in Alaska. And this curvature through the data shows that the rate of mass loss is increasing. And we know that this dynamic component that exists at the marine glaciers is dominating the mass loss signal. Okay, so one last time, I'll summarize this. This is the most important thing to take home from this talk, I think. Here we have Antarctica, here we have Greenland, and here's the small glaciers. In white, I show the reservoir, the potential reservoir of ice transferred to the sea. So you again see that the small glaciers are tiny. But in red is the percentage contribution to eustatic sea level rise. So you see that the little glaciers are winning right now. But the question is this trend going to continue? So we look at this two different possible scenarios, and we project this out into the future. So here's what's happening from 1990 to the present, we have an acceleration in the rate of mass loss. We'll speculate on two separate cases. One, the mass loss doesn't change anymore. We keep it at today's level. The other one is that we keep increasing that mass loss at the observed rate today. And we'll project this out until the end of the 21st century. We're not tying this to climate at all. By doing that, we're focusing more on these dynamic changes than the climate, because we think that that's the real important thing. We're focusing on the dynamics. And I'll just point out that both of our estimates are likely underestimating the potential for sea level change. Okay, so here, the best way I can summarize this is in a table. And it's a little bit busy, but I think I can walk you through it. In green, we have mass gains. In red, we have mass losses. And in yellow, I highlight the biggest mass loss. So this column here says, okay, here's the small glaciers. We have Greenland, we have Antarctica, and then we total them all at the bottom. And each one of these rows talks about those two scenarios that I just mentioned, no change or a linear change. And so right now, the small glaciers have the biggest component. I think you get that from, I've said it enough times. If we go out to 2050, what happens under those two scenarios? The current acceleration is always going to provide more ice to the sea. And under that either of those scenarios, the small glaciers will dominate. And by 2050, we'll have 81 millimeters of additional water in the world's oceans. The global total, 160 millimeters. If we go out to 2100, the end of the century, now Greenland is slightly larger than the small glaciers, but not significantly. So the small glaciers are keeping up with Greenland through the end of the century under these two hypothetical situations. And here you see that East Antarctica has the potential to start losing mass instead of gaining mass by the end of the century. And so our estimate for a global total is up to half a meter at the end of the century. And we feel that this is likely an underestimate. So it's a bigger number than the IPCC published. And it's because we've tried to incorporate at least a zeroth order estimate of what can happen to the dynamics. So to try and interpret these numbers, it's really challenging to interpret these numbers and make sure that our result is valid. But we have several sources of errors. We have some unbiased errors from the measurements. Some of the methods are going to overestimate some places, and others are going to underestimate. And taken together, those probably cancel each other out. We have several kinds of errors that underestimate sea level rise. And I'm running out of time, so I won't talk about these. But we don't know the dynamics. There's going to be runoff as the poles warm that we're not including. And then there's this strong mass balance altitude feedback. We have other errors that overestimate sea level rise. We're not accounting for the loss of ice originally below sea level. We've done some estimations at Columbia Glacier. It's negligible, and so we're ignoring it. We're not accounting for water that's meltwater refreezing in the polar fern, and we're not accounting for area losses. Taken together, we feel that those errors don't change dramatically the results of our study. They might change it by 5% or so. How do these impact the small glaciers? This is an important slide. Counter to your intuition, only about less than or equal to 35% of the glaciers are likely to disappear, the small glaciers. And why is that true? Well, glacier volume scales non-linearly with area. So if you increase the area, you have a much bigger reservoir there. About half of the small glacier volume is locked up in these big glaciers, and they're not going to thin enough to disappear by the end of the century. The sad thing is that most of our long-term records of glacier history are on small glaciers, really small glaciers that are easy to access, and most of these are going to disappear. We think there's about a 50-meter threshold for which glaciers are going to disappear by the end of the century. So, to summarize, what I'd like you to take home is that the transfer of ice from terrestrial storage to the sea accounts for almost all of the new water contribution to sea level observed today. And the glaciers and ice caps are the cryospheric system that's being altered the fastest, and this will continue for the next several decades. Thanks. So the question is the equilibrium state where the geometry, the thickness and length of the glacier is steady, is that common? And the answer is really no. The climate has always been changing. And it's always, the temperature and precipitation is always bouncing up and down, wiggling its way along. And so the glacier never has time to get used to that climate before it's already changed. And so it's continuously in adjustment. And so the equilibrium state is something that we use to derive mathematical theory, but isn't necessarily the most applicable thing. I showed one picture of the seal on the glacier in the dry valleys, and that's probably the closest thing to the equilibrium state on planet Earth. So this question's about, does the erosion of the Earth from the glaciers, the rocks that the glacier erodes and plucks and then deposits somewhere, does that make a difference? And I'm not a geomorphologist, that's not my main focus, but I do know that is important in several different ways. The glaciers plow this stuff up in front of them in what we think of as terminal moraine. So it's basically a big mud pile underneath the terminus. And those mud piles are really important to the marine glaciers in providing stability. And if they retreat off of those mud piles is when we see these catastrophic retreats happen. There is erosion of that as the Earth is eroded, we get isostatic uplift in those areas. Some of the highest rates of uplift are in the Glacier Bay area of southeast Alaska. I think they're close to a centimeter a year. And that's making that, the effect of that is a local sea level drop. So southeast Alaska is a very unique case. Even though global sea level is rising, the residents of southeast Alaska are watching more of their property come out of the ocean, and they're excited about that. So, you have a question? His question is about, you know, I'm talking mostly about retreating glaciers, and that seems to be the dominant trend, but are there any that are bucking the trend and advancing? And the answer is yes, but they're very uncommon. The ones I know about are Hubbard Glacier in Alaska, and there's some tidewater glaciers in Norway that are advancing, and there's probably a few systems in Antarctica that are advancing, that's the main ones. There's a few others in Alaska that are advancing. The caveat is that they're all these marine terminating glaciers, and I wasn't careful enough about this, but these tidewater glaciers, the glaciers that end in the sea, because the dynamics are strongly nonlinear, that means that they're not a direct proxy for climate change. We think that they might have some threshold where the climate changes and then they have this catastrophic failure as a response to the climate. But they can also do anomalous things to what the rest are doing and advance in a given climate where most things are retreating. You can take Hubbard Glacier as an example. It's always been out of phase from what we can tell from the geologic record. And so it went through a big retreat several hundred years ago. And right now, even under a decreasing snowfall, it's got none of this ablation area that I talked about because it just finished retreating. All the ablation area calved off and is now out in the global ocean. And so there's a very small region where we have more melt than snowfall. And so basically under any climate you could give it, as long as it's snowing on the glacier, it's going to advance. It won't advance as far as it did in a colder climate. But so there are some of these anomalies. They're very rare, and they don't indicate that terrestrial glaciers aren't a good proxy for climate warming.
Maybe one more question?
Sure. That picture from the question is Childs Glacier. Garrett's one of the surfers that was up at Childs Glacier in Alaska surfing. What's happening to Childs Glacier, and then what month did that massive event happen in Greenland? So I'll answer the second question first. That calving event in Greenland was from this June, and Greenland seems to have a bit of a different cycle. It seems to start calving around March and continue through the fall, and it stops calving all winter. And Greenland seems to have more episodic massive failure than we see in Alaska, where it's almost more of a continuous process with some variations in the process, but it's always going on. And then the Childs Glacier I know very little about, but it is calving into a river instead of the ocean. And so its calving is mostly controlled by thermal erosion by the river flowing past the terminus, and it's in very shallow water. It's probably not capable of making these monster bergs, and because it's in shallow water, that's basically the river is acting like a terminal moraine, and so it's providing a lot of stability to the glacier. I don't know the history, if it's got a huge accumulation area relative to its ablation area, but the fact that it's in shallow water will provide it much more stability than an ocean terminating glacier.
Thank you very much.